Hello and welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us, News of the Money World. Thank you for joining us, Rupert. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you this morning, Darcy?
Very good, very good. But I am determined today that we're going to get through as much stuff as we possibly can, because we always leave like two-thirds of what we really wanted to talk about on the table. So shall we get stuck into it? I'll take you through them right now. So firstly, interest rates, they're falling with the banks. We've seen that recently here in New Zealand. Many speculate lower and sooner now after thinking higher for longer. We were talking about this just now, myself included. So it's an interesting kind of time right now on the interest rate front. And staying on and connected to the interest rate, the ANZ is under the microscope amid claims of bond market manipulation, with many suggesting that they'll probably not be brought back to justice or brought to justice. And then you're going to take us through what the great stock rotation means and how the interest rate changes have caused investors to search for the next bucket of outperformance. In local news with the NZX, the Warehouse Group and Arvida are two of the ones that I'm aware of that have received bids well above market prices. And if we get time, we'll tackle Trump and his plans to dump Gary Gensler and his plans to make Bitcoin a strategic reserve. So yeah, there's a few categories here. So maybe let's talk about interest rates, shall we? Because, hey, they are coming down. I've seen them come down with the banks just even last week, significant drops in retail mortgage rates. Wholesale markets for interest rates are down really significantly. And obviously, traders are speculating and expecting quite a significant cut from the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, which isn't necessarily what they're saying, but that's what they're expecting. So what's going on? What's going on with interest rates, Rupert?
Yeah, look, fundamentally, I think there's a very strong view that we've beaten and we've won the inflation game. We saw that with the inflation stats late a couple of weeks ago now, where inflation came in and kind of low threes. And there is now full confidence from most people that inflation should fall back within that kind of 1% to 3% band by the end of this year. And that's given people a lot of increased certainty to change their interest rate forecasts and interest rate pricing. So it's really interesting when you look at the wholesale market right now. Wholesale interest rates are down almost 1.5% from their October highs. So that's a massive shift, right? Banks haven't passed that through yet. It kind of means banks are earning pretty hefty margins on their mortgage products right now. They haven't needed to chase or go fighting for volume, which is a bit of a shame. I wonder what the Commerce Commission will be thinking about this current activity. Yeah, I reckon if banks are willing to accept the same margins they've had for the last 4 or 5 years, then theoretically we're in line for probably another 1% drop in mortgages over the next couple of months.
And that's significant, right? Because if you look at like where interest rates probably need to be, just in the, if you're coming from a property centric perspective, you look at where interest rates need to be in order to tip the scales between renting a home and buying a home. A $1 million home, let's say on average, might cost $700 a week to rent. And I was doing the numbers before. Interest rates would actually have to drop to 4.5%. For the interest cost alone, not the principal and interest payments, but just for the interest cost alone on an 80% mortgage, that would be an $800,000 mortgage required to buy that $1 million home for it to be the same as what the rent cost of around about $700 a week. So it's an interesting kind of thing that I've seen in the past quite a few times, where it's like when the interest cost gets below what the rent is, which is rare, but it does happen, it really puts a lot of upward pressure on property prices. And then the inverse is true, and property prices keep on following until it kind of reaches that magical sweet spot. And that's just from a property perspective, but everything else seems to be connected to credit growth, and credit growth is strongly influenced by interest rates. So the fact that these margins aren't being passed on implies a couple of things, doesn't it? Like it implies that, hey, the banks are being greedy. Doubt that would ever be a possibility. Or it could be, how's that sarcasm? Almost too subtle. Could be that maybe
we'll
the banks are
just, next topic.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe the banks are just helping the Reserve Bank do their job, right? Yeah, wholesale markets have dropped, but hey, we're worried that maybe we might kind of trigger a bit more inflation or reflation. So what do you think it is? Like, why do you think that the market has dropped so much and the banks haven't done it? Like, would you speculate that it's purely greed behind this, or is there something else going on?
I think there's three things happening. One is I think the banks are pretty nervous on the economic outlook, and so therefore they will be being quite picky about what they're taking on and what they're not taking on. There'll be a strong view at the moment that they don't need to push the boat out on lending. They don't need to go after the marginal borrowers, and they don't need to fight for market share. I think that's probably, so they're kind of sitting there going happily, you know what? We're happy to kind of increase our margins. There is, if I was going to be entirely fair, which I don't like being, there is an argument that actually the margins the banks are earning on those mortgage products have compressed a fair amount over the last 5 or 6 years as interest rates have come down. So the margins they're currently earning, probably more in line with where they were kind of in that kind of 2013 to 2015, 16, 17 kind of range. But I think it's kind of, yeah, but fundamentally for me, it's kind of, that's them protecting profit. So it's they're taking the view that we're better off less lending, but higher margin is a better way to generate more profits. And then the third way, which might be again slightly kind, is interest rates have been pretty volatile over the last kind of 18 months, 2 years, and they probably are wanting to see some certainty from the Reserve Bank that actually what is being priced into the wholesale markets is correct and isn't going to whipsaw, because I imagine it'll cause them a whole lot of headaches if they start dropping interest rates and then 3 months later have to start increasing interest rates again as well, right? So there's a whole lot of factors at play, but I do think the biggest one is at the moment, the banks are probably happier, less lending with higher profits at the moment.
Yeah, okay. There's a lot more to get into on that one, but moving on to something kind of related to interest rates, but in a different way. So in the bond market, we have bonds, which are inversely connected to interest rates. So the higher the interest rates go, the lower the bond price goes. And over the ditch, and I think there's actually been some allegations here in New Zealand as well against ANZ, ANZ has allegedly traded in the futures market to artificially increase the interest rates on government bonds, thereby reducing the price for them. And then after they're issued, they reverse the trade, allowing the bond prices to rise, and then they profit from the difference. I hope I have that right, especially if the same lawyers that are probably going to be defending ANZ are watching the show. But if you have a different version of that, let me know. But is that more or less what's going on right now in terms of these allegations?
Yeah, so I think there's a bit of manipulation that's gone on just before the, or allegedly there has been some manipulation that has gone on just before these bond auctions. I think it kind of addresses one of the fundamental problems though as well. The bond market is extremely opaque, very hard to see inside it. Most bonds trade on kind of, there's not an open market like the stock exchange. They'd kind of trade on individual trading desks, and the banks control most of it. And so these are highly profitable parts of most of the banks. And it is really interesting, right? I think what it probably does show in Australia, there's a Royal Commission 4 or 5 years ago, which was meant to address a whole lot of this stuff and kind of do a good job at kind of cleaning up and getting some of that culture and conduct and behavior a whole lot better. I think this shows there's a hell of a lot more work to do. That's pretty clear that the same thing, the allegations are that the same thing has been happening here in New Zealand, where there's been similar allegations. But then when you think about it, from what I've been told, it's the same people on the same trading desks. So why, if they're doing it in Australia and making it super profitable, why wouldn't they do it here in New Zealand? I think it's just another piece of evidence. We've said to ourselves for a long time here in New Zealand, we don't need to look at the New Zealand banks. They're very different to their Australian parents. They're much better behaved. I think everything that we see is actually the opposite. And whether it come to kind of record-breaking net interest margin because of the low profitability, now we've got these allegations of market manipulation. I think it's time we change the narrative around you'd rather banks be too profitable than not profitable enough. I think it's time to do something about it personally.
I find it fascinating though, because I think it's quite a broad issue. It's also an issue of justice, I think, that those organizations or those people, usually organizations that have the ability to hire the best legal team, seem to be able to continue to do what they're doing, or at the very least get away with things for a lot longer than what they should. And even just this morning, I was reading a notification coming out of the Financial Markets Authority, the FMA here in New Zealand, issuing a breach notice to an individual for alleged market manipulation on their shares account. So obviously it's easier to hit some targets than other targets, right? And I think there's a real issue of justice here, which favors consolidation within the financial services industry. And it is it's kind of like dirty laundry. Yeah, it is dirty laundry. It's something that probably doesn't really want to be confessed to. But in my view, it is always easier to allow bigger organizations to self-regulate than to allow many market participants to be regulated. So there's a lot going on with this one issue, I think, that highlights that.
Very much. And I think that, and the other big issue with a lot of it, in my book as well, a lot of it's actually settled behind closed doors. And so it means as general public, it's kind of, we don't know about a lot of what happened because a lot of it is confidential settlements and without getting the full story. And it is a really interesting approach. There was one that was talked about in a similar vein that was kind of mentioned in the NBR a couple of days ago. And it was a case where basically, again, it was alleged market manipulation. And then there'd been kind of significant complaints about this market manipulation. That's right, was on the warehouse. But the only reason anyone found out about the market manipulation, the fact that it was being investigated, was because someone leaked it to the NBR, whereas typically a lot of the stuff is just swept under the carpet. And so it is kind of quite sad that people, individual complainants, are now going, well, the only way I can actually make this properly looked at is if I leak it to the media.
Yeah. On the flip side, though, it's kind of cool that we have a media occasionally who is willing to do that kind of work. It's just that maybe the target market to consume that type of media is quite small in New Zealand. So why would they bother? I don't know. There's a lot connected to that one as well. Let's keep going though. Changing expectations with interest rates, yeah, hurting consumers in the US. I was reading an interesting report from MSNBC. Yeah. Around McDonald's. Effectively, what it seems like is they're losing pricing power. And in their words, they recognize that they're not in the value space anymore and customers are going elsewhere or buying lower value items off their menu. And I wonder when businesses like that are losing pricing power like that, especially when they have such a around their business model in terms of brand and stuff like that. I kind of think, well, what does that say about the actual US consumer? And or what does it say around the separation increasingly between Main Street and Wall Street, where we have amazing performance from now, not just the Mag 7, but the Fantastic Four. And like, what is going on? So do you want to take me through what we've seen in this great stock rotation recently? And maybe we can speculate as to what that means is going on.
I think, well, actually, the McDonald's point is actually a fascinating second part to it, right? Yeah. July has been a very interesting month in the market so far. The trades that have worked for the past 3-4 years have not worked, to be blunt. The NASDAQ, which is the tech-heavy kind of focus, that's slightly down. And then what you've got is the Russell 2000, which has been struggling for the last 3 years, is up kind of close to 8 to 10%. And so it's one of the first times, I think, ever that the Russell 2000 has outperformed the NASDAQ in such a small time, such a small period. Even when we look at the New Zealand market, which is basically flatlined kind of on its deathbed for the last kind of 2 or 3 years, that's now up 6-7% in the last kind of 6 to 8 weeks. And this has been driven by interest rates, because there's a strong perception that smaller businesses do better in an interest rate sensitive environment. We've talked about New Zealand in the past doing really well with lower interest rates, because we've got 70% of our market is either property, retirement, or utilities, all highly interest rate sensitive and dividend paying stocks. And so we've kind of started to see this rotation where now we've got the certainty on interest rates. People are trying to position their stock portfolios for it. There's also a bit of concern about the valuation at the Uber cap levels. But what I find really interesting is your McDonald's story, because actually small cap stocks and smaller cap stocks, and we don't think about it like this, but McDonald's is a small cap stock in the US, they are much more sensitive to the underlying economic environment. And so I think that's the big debate going through in my mind. The stock market has rotated to kind of and has accepted that, hey, lower interest rates are here, they're coming, and they're going to stay. But they're kind of discounting the second part of that story, which is they're coming because we've got a much weaker economic environment, and consumers are struggling. There's no question on it, right? Consumers around the world are really struggling in this current economic climate.
So it's kind of like going to hurt some companies' earnings. Yeah, so it's like too little, too late, knowing that interest rates are coming, maybe, because the consumers are so damaged by it. And I guess that's the problem when you try to manipulate interest rates to control economic activities, that you're going to overshoot and undershoot. So does this imply then that we're not really able to reach that soft landing place of nirvana?
Well, I think we don't know, right? I think what we have seen over the last probably 3-5 years is interest rates have been the blunt tool that's been used to deliver a whole lot of the economic activity. Is actually it's kind of hit middle and lower class, more middle. It's kind of means that the super affluent have did extremely well on the increasing interest rate environment, because that kind of ballooned asset prices. And it's probably that middle class that's really struggling. This is really a middle class recession to a certain extent,
is it?
Where all the people with high levels of debt, the people that used to eat out kind of once or twice a month, the people that were happy to spend $40, $50 kind of maybe once a week or once a month at McDonald's, those are the people that have been hit by these higher interest rates. The uber wealthy, to be blunt, they don't have mortgages, so they're still uber wealthy and haven't really impacted. And then those without mortgages. And I think what we're starting to see, as we've got lower home ownership across the world, we're actually seeing it's a more concentrated impact. And so, yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see where this lands. But I suspect there will be more pain to come. And small caps is probably not where you want to be in a tough economic environment. So this might be another example of the market getting ahead of itself.
Maybe. Yeah, I like that term though, middle class recession, because that totally sums up, I think, what it has been, middle and lower class.
And that's why we're also seeing the politics that we're seeing, right? Where you go, because the middle is being thoroughly hollowed out across the world, right? And this is, I mean, we're good at beating ourselves up about what's happening in New Zealand, but it is no different anywhere in the world, right? A hollowing of the middle class in the UK is what drove Brexit. A hollowing of the middle class in the US is what's driven Trump. That's where we are is no different. But I think what we're seeing right now is definitely that final kind of death knell for a lot of the middle classes around the world.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on to brighter news. If you were a shareholder the Warehouse Group and in Arvida, you would be pretty happy right about now, right? So there's been, I guess, preliminary proposal from founder Stephen Tindall and Adamantem to potentially acquire all the company shares. So $1.50 to $1.70 above the $1.43 where it's at right now. Arvida also receiving some strong interest above the market, 65% above the market. What is all that takeover interest on the NZX actually telling us?
I think there's a couple of things, right? The best time to be buying is at the bottom of the market, right? That's an obvious thing. But off of what we've seen historically is when people have bought assets in the recessions, they generally do pretty well out of them, right? So whether you think about it being GFC, I mean, Warren Buffett, I mean, an absolute killing through all of his investments through that period. A whole lot of people bought up assets in 2020, did extremely well. And I think it comes back to that old adage of be fearful when everyone's brave and be brave when everyone's fearful. And there's no question that NZX, I think, probably has been oversold. The investor, how do I describe it? The investor appetite for New Zealand just is not there. There isn't really anything exciting. There's nothing really sexy on the NZX. The funds, even the KiwiSaver funds, are kind of increasing their allocations offshore because it's too hard to deploy money here in New Zealand at the moment. And so what that means is for companies like Arvida, companies like The Warehouse, companies that have not done all that well and are really struggling and kind of have some strong intrinsic value, people are turning up and going, hold on a sec, I can see the value there and I know what to do with it. To be fair, it is a really hard one to kind of work your way through because public shareholders don't have the management teams that an Adamantem or someone like that's going to do. So I'd suggest they probably can do a better job of it than it can in its listed space, particularly if they can have a 5-year horizon rather than thinking quarterly. But yeah, it is a really interesting kind of phenomenon, right? Because I think the article I was read a couple of days ago, New Zealand's got on average over the last kind of 12, 18 months, I think on average we're taking one delisting a month. And there's only been one or two new IPOs. And it is pretty scary on what's going to happen and whether we end up managing to retain a capital markets or not. But at the same time, it's also pretty hard, right? Because our listed businesses have not been well managed, have not done a great job at operating, and therefore they haven't created a good return for their investors, which is why the investors are now looking offshore. Arguably, the investors needed to be more active and they need to encourage some better kind of activities and be more long-term. But yeah, it's a really challenging one. And I think it's hard to see the NZX coming back from here, actually.
Yeah, well, I'm still very much a student with these matters, but I really think that it makes a lot of sense when we have a really good, startup ecosystem within New Zealand, it really makes a lot of sense that they should be working in that space right there, helping the private equity stuff come up from the bottom a lot easier. And I know that there's some innovation that's currently yep. going on there, and I wish them all the best, because I think that's probably where we're going to get some life out of the NZX, is to reinvent itself as something that can, I guess, grow the number eight startups here in New Zealand to make sure they stay here. Because if they stay here to start with, I think the rest of it probably becomes a lot easier in terms of the next step.
But it's a really hard one, right? And because I'm firmly of the view that actually the issue sits in my industry, and it sits in the funds management world. And because every other market in the world has quite a strong small cap kind of industry and small cap community. And you need the small cap funds to be able to kind of invest in small businesses, to be able to take a bit more risk, to be able to kind of specialize. And the problem is the New Zealand market's just not big enough, right? You go and build yourself a $200 million small cap fund where you want to specialize across 20 kind of, well, typically if you're offshore and you had a small cap fund, you'd want to specialize across to your $200 million fund across kind of 10 or 20 names. New Zealand market's not big enough for that, right? And it's almost the size of our market is making it harder and harder for us to create the ecosystem to make it more successful. I think there are some issues around the four very, very large retail brokerage firms, and the fact that we're one of the last countries in the world where direct investing is still kind of the way that most people invest. So there are a couple of issues there, but I do think it's actually, if we want to solve this problem, we're going to have to solve and think harder about how people invest, be more realistic about what fees we expect our clients to pay. And the regulator needs to be clearer on that around, actually, if we're a small market, we want a small kind of cap ecosystem, and we want fund managers to be viable at $200-$400 million. That requires a completely different way of thinking from everyone in the ecosystem right now. But unless we can create that, we're not solving the NZX problems. Mm. If anything, we might as well just give up and move everything to Australia.
You're sounding a little bit negative today, Rupert.
I've been consistent on that one for a long time. I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that it's actually the investment. It is the structure of the investment market, which is what's making the NZX so hard, right? Because at the end of the day, actually, a market is just a place where you bring together buyers and sellers. And I think there would be a whole lot of sellers and a whole lot of companies that would be happy to list, even under the current settings, if they were confident that they were going to get a whole series of really interesting, good buyers, aka investors, that were going to do a good job for them. And I don't think we've got that environment here in New Zealand just yet.
Is there a solution which involves a significant renovation, or does it require detonation and the replacement with the entire structure and the way that it's regulated and the rules, legislation that goes along with it? Is that kind of what would need to happen? Because clearly,
I think the two things that I would potentially like to see, which will change some of it, if you agree with my hypothesis, which is it's a lack of small cap managers, which are causing the issue. I think two things I would like to see. I personally would like to see the government step in and take a role here. I mean, at the end of the day, the government controls, I reckon, between ACC, NZ Super, some of the various government pension schemes, they've probably got $80 billion. Why can't they set up and start building out small cap funds for us? You could easily create ACC needs to have a $200 million, $300 million allocation to NZ small caps that needs to be managed in New Zealand, needs to be managed in-house. You do the same for NZ Super. You do the same for some of the other things. You could have the government. You could also have incentives around KiwiSaver managers, right? If I want to set up a small cap fund, if I'm going to be a small cap manager, that's pretty hard, right? Because I can charge 1% for that fund, but I need a whole world of infrastructure plus three or four really smart guys to actually go in and create that ecosystem. And that's, to be blunt with you, that I struggle to make that profitable. Yeah. And so therefore, I would like to see the government potentially turn around and go, you know what, small cap funds, we're actually going to provide some support. But I think it's not detonation. It's not a complete renovation. It's actually going, cool, how do we create a world where we kind of have the small cap kind of environment, the small cap set of funds out there, and how that kind of works. But the moment we get that ecosystem working, I guarantee the companies will start to list.
So really, it's like you say, it's neither detonation nor renovation. It's more of a government catalyst or a boost rather than constant government involvement. It's just more of a, hey, we've now got something just to kickstart something, which should have positive feedback loops once it gets started and there's more investor flows going through there, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right. I agree. And they already do a lot of it with the NZ Venture Funds, a lot of that stuff. But I think they're probably missing the next stage of where they need to go. And I do think there's an opportunity here for government to step in and deal with this. Right. And it should be cost neutral for them, right? This is a nice market intervention that they can make, which potentially costs them.
Yeah, yeah. My non-interventionist libertarian bones in my body are crying out here, but I'll suppress them until we get to the next topic. So completely changing topics from the NZX and the issues that we have there. Let's now talk to the much, much, much bigger market, the US market. We have an election year, and I think this election year is far more influential, not just for the US markets, but for the entire world than what we give it credit for. I used to think, probably before the global financial crisis, actually, like elections were just a complete waste of time. And why even think about it? But since then, it seems like every 4 years, there's a run up in the Bitcoin price. And there's a whole range of policies that seem to affect everybody in almost every country. And I wonder just how synced up it is to this election cycle. So with Trump, you know, hands in the air, fight, fight, fight. That's changed the ball game. We now have some competition in the form of Kamala Harris. And who knows where that's going to go. But meanwhile, this weekend that's just been, while some people were watching the Olympics opening ceremony, I was watching something much more edifying. I was watching a lot of the Bitcoin Conference 2024, and I was listening to people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Michael Saylor, Edward Snowden, and Donald Trump. And he vowed to make Bitcoin a strategic asset. And a lot of the Bitcoin that was scooped up during the Silk Road raid, I believe it was, he said, hey, we're not going to sell that. Yep. We're going to make sure that we hang on to that. And we're going to be the leaders in Bitcoin, full stop, which I think just from a game theory point of view is like very smart, regardless of what you think with Bitcoin, makes a lot of sense. He's going to get rid of Gary Gensler, enemy number one, probably next to Elizabeth Warren when it comes to the crypto community and the headaches that it's caused. Meanwhile, though, just like 24, 48 hours ago, we've seen $2 billion worth of Bitcoin move from that address, specifically the Bitcoin that Donald Trump wanted to make the reserve asset. So I just wonder if they're trying to make his job just a little bit harder should he get into power. So fascinating things going on. And I don't know if I have that entirely correct, but there's fascinating things afoot. And you're seeing like Bitcoin almost hit an all-time high just last night, just to be dumped again today. So extremely volatile. We're knocking on all-time high doors. And I think if we go past that 70K mark and it's sustained, we're going to see a lot more retail interest. And that's when I would suspect we're going to see a proper bull run. Speculating, definitely not suggesting that people should pile in. But fascinating times with Bitcoin. If you watch that space, what are your thoughts?
Oh, it's absolutely amazing, right? Apparently, Kamala Harris is now working on her crypto policy, which will come out in the next couple of days. That'll because be I think people figured out that they want to go after these donors. There's a huge amount of money in that, and that's kind of where they're in. I think, I'll be honest, I am a little bit surprised at the lack of market reaction to these policies. I would have thought that should have been a bit stronger and done a bit more. I'm guessing there's two things going on in the background. Because actually, when we think about it, the market's basically flat from where it was back in last week, long time before these announcements. I'm guessing the markets are just going, you know what? It's not going to happen. Trump's very good at promising a hell of a lot. And often what he promises doesn't necessarily get delivered. And then as the National Party here in New Zealand are finding out right now, the tentacles of the state are often a lot longer than everyone understands. And just having a leader say it shall be, it needs a lot more than that to make it happen. Right. And I think that's probably a little bit of some of the fear that's going on right now where they're going, or how do we actually get this done? Is it going to get done? Because, yeah, you would have thought from Sunday, all of a sudden, we've got the legitimization of crypto and of Bitcoin, but the market doesn't seem to be buying it, to be blunt.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of what we probably consume in the media, or what mainstream people consume in mainstream media, is probably more centered around the political story, whereas the monetary story, which isn't as sexy because you're just listening to bankers, right, and policymakers. I think those are the tentacles that I would be probably more cognizant of when thinking about how things could evolve with Bitcoin, specifically as it relates to Bitcoin potentially being a strategic reserve asset of the US. Yeah. I think there's definitely a sense of insecurity that somehow that puts the US dollar at risk. But I think that once you dig a little bit deeper, it's actually really smart because it creates a demand for US dollars because of that relationship between the two. The market that exists around Bitcoin is pretty much all denominated in US dollars. And so I think just with a few strokes of a pen, everybody can actually be made better off. And by everybody, I mean Bitcoin holders. It's just a shame I lost all of mine in a boating accident. Again, I keep on kicking myself. But There is definitely going to be some interesting developments, I'd suggest, in the next 6 months. So if I could, I would. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see where it goes. I think I'll be fascinated to see what Kamala Harris comes out with, because if she comes out with something real and something interesting, then it's no longer a debate around who wins, and it's no longer a debate around, well, it's relying on Trump. I think it's got potential to move pretty quickly into the mainstream right now.
Yeah. No, I agree. But it's just really fascinating though, right? Like Kamala Harris, if on the Democratic side, they come out with something there, they're going to have to make it quite convincing, because I think the public is probably a little bit cynical based on the history. They're not going to forget too easily. Donald Trump, when he was kind of presenting, he was saying all the right things, but you can tell he was just putting it on for the people and he was saying the right things. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., though, this guy is quite fascinating. Apart from, like, he sounds like, just the way he talks is difficult to understand, because it sounds like he's always crying, but he's not. That's just his voice. But he really gets it. He really, really gets it. Like, he's been in it for a year by the sounds of it. He really understands the core issues. And I just hope that the powers that be that took care of his uncle aren't going to come after him if he gets too far down that road. Fascinating stuff, though, right? I'm going to leave that one hanging.
Awesome. I'm not going to buy it.
Okay, that's cool. All right, well, we did it. We did it, man. We covered five topics in one session. That is amazing. We all deserve a pat on the back. Fantastic. Hey, thank you very much. And we're going to catch up with you again next week. So let's do it. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Darcy. And we will speak to you soon.
Cheers. Right.